Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
There's a question that's been bugging me for a while now.
How many flies have ever existed?
Crowd Science, the podcast with a thirst for knowledge.
Why do we daydream?
Why is the sea salty?
We'll go and try and speak to some people and find out.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we are wondering why around 95 or so Libyans were released and deported after they managed to enter South Africa and train at an illegal military camp.
If this was, for example, nationals from another African country, would they have received the same kind of treatment in terms of being deported so quickly and easily back to their country? And I think also the fact that they had such good legal representation expediently also raises questions.
And how come Lesotho is able to keep the taps running in South Africa, but it can't provide safe water for its own citizens?
We are now giving 19 million people water in South Africa. We can't give 2 million people water in Lesotho. There's something wrong. These things should have been run parallel. We've come up with a new strategic plan, which will make sure that those people get water and they also get electricity. So the hope is that by 2030, the lowlands will have ample water for everybody.
It's Thursday, the 22nd of August. First, we go to Kinshasa. The Democratic Republic of Congo is vast. Forests abound and a mighty river flows through it. After the River Nile, the River Congo is the longest in Africa. That river has very many tributaries, but the country has very few roads, so people rely on boats and ferries to travel up and down the country. Accidents on the river are not unusual, but the frequency with which they happen is worrying. A boat carrying more than 300 people sank over the weekend. In June, at least 80 people, including 12 children, drowned when the boat they were in sank. Overloading is often the problem. But let's discuss the issue with Biobe Malenga, a journalist in Kinshasa. We began our conversation with details of the latest accident.
The shipwreck happened in the night of Sunday, August 18. On the river Lukeni. Lukeni is in territory of Kutu in Maindombe province. It is in the center west of Democratic Republic of Congo, and it was with more than 300 passengers on board. 200 people are right now missing. 40 of them are just rescued by the Safety Services Department.
Do we know how it sank and why it sank?
Right now, you know, in Democratic Republic of Congo, the reason is a lack of strictness of the law in the navigation and transportation of boats, because the department concerned with the water safety has been letting boats and ships travel, leading passengers or businesses to leave without considering the weight that the ship should carry. So also there is in many places in the country, boats or ships are the backbone of transportation due to the lack of road infrastructure. So people use water transportation a lot.
And so a ship like the one that these people were on, how big would you say it was and how many people was it meant to carry legally? Because you're saying that weight is often a problem.
Yeah, you know, civil society organizations by many times is just declaring that the government should make measures to make sure that before boat or ship to leave, they have to check everything, weight, how many passengers, how many kilograms of business is inside, because that is the main of problem and the reason to make the ship to ring.
These things keep happening. This is not the first time it's happened. It's not the last time it will happen. What do local people say and how do they react when this happens? I'm sure if some of us were in that position, we'd get quite angry at the fact that, you know, these accidents seem to happen quite regularly?
Ordinary citizens, as well as civil society organizations, have been blaming the government for failing to take actions to ensure safety in water transportation has been maintained and such accidents have been avoided.
So who are the people that own these ferries, the service providers? Are they, you know, big businesses with lots of ferries, or is it a combination?
Yeah, the owner of this are from private and the public and is combined.
Why does the government not take action to make sure that the boats are safe?
The government has been required to respect the law, prohibiting boats that are not suitable to carrying passengers and businesses, and also to have a close inspection of people whenever there is a ship or boat transport, and not only in the Congo River, but also in the lake, like Tanganyika or Kivu. But it's like a corruption. People, the owner of boats, they are giving money to the government representative to make sure that they live with business and passengers.
Are there many of these boats? I'm asking you that question because I'm wondering whether people can, if they see that a boat is overloaded or if a particular provider has a reputation for overloading boats, they can just say, no, I'm not going on this ship. I'm waiting for the next one, or I'm going on another line. Do people have a choice, in other words?
In Congo, there is no other way to move from this side to that side. There is some part of Congo, there is no road, there is no airplane. So they have only one way to move, is the water. So they don't have choice. They have to use only boats if they need to move from this side to that side. So from this province to that province. There is no only one boat who knows that this is the company who's doing accident. So they don't have choice. They just carry any boat they see that is going that side, they have to carry inside.
About the rescue and emergency services, how effective are they? How efficient are they?
The emergency rescue department for some areas do not exist. And even the areas that are available, there is no necessary equipment to make sure that if there is an accident, they're supposed to do everything to make sure that there is there on time, or they have equipment to make sure that this is the right area we have to repair. The accident is that side. That is the problem.
And I suppose when people are rescued, it happens with the support of local people around there. So the people who are trying to rescue them are not necessarily people who are trained then in doing it, right?
Yeah. Most of people who are trying to support them to make sure there is a survivor, they are not trained.
And what about the survivors? It must be a terrifying experience to be on an overloaded boat, to go underwater, to not be sure that you will be rescued. What happens to them afterwards? Is there any way that they can be, you know, counseled for the trauma that they experience? Or do people just shake it off and carry on living, trying to survive as best they can?
Yeah, sometimes most of them are supported by the government to make sure that they have people who's trying to do like counseling. And most of them are just supported by local NGO.
Are there quite a few NGOs who actually do that, who do help people?
Yeah, as I say, there is some NGO or who's doing that, trying to support survivors.
So when people put to the government that this, you know, can't continue happening, what is the government's reaction when people say that they really should enforce the law?
The government is always saying that they deploy this tragedy and they are trying to make measures to make sure that tragedies like that do not happen again.
And yet they keep on happening.
It's keeping happening, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Biobe Malenga in Kinshasa. Let's listen to what the governor for Mai Ndombe province, Leon Nkoso Kevani, said in response to the tragedy.
The real problem is always night navigation and then overloading. So these are elements that are often the cause of sinking of unsecured boats. So we as authorities are going to take measures and also propose an alternative to the situation because we must have secure boats. And I believe this is what is planned in our action program. We will do it in a few months and there will already be secure boats. We have set up a commission in a few hours. It will be there to establish responsibilities.
We're going to return to a story that has South Africans asking questions. It's about the Libyans that were arrested during a police raid on an illegal military training camp. Around 95 men, all of them Libyan, were arrested and charged for breaching South Africa's immigration laws. At the time of the arrest, the police said the group had misrepresented themselves on their visa applications by saying they would be training as security guards. They duly appeared in court. What happened next is what surprised everybody. All charges against the men were dropped, and then they were sent back to Libya. Now, South Africans are wondering, how did the Libyans get their visas in the first place? What were they actually doing in South Africa? And why were the charges against them dropped? Professor Nirmala Gopal is a criminologist at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. She came up with some answers, but she too was surprised by the turn of events.
I mean, I was really confused, I must say, because I thought that the Department of Home Affairs had a solid case in terms of their charge. And I also expected that the charge was based on their own groundwork. So I was extremely confused.
What was confusing? Because I'll tell you what was confusing for me was that they were charged with what seemed to be a fairly minor infraction, you know, visa irregularities, rather than actually people who had entered the country and were receiving training at an illegal military camp.
I don't think that a visa irregularity is minor in any way. A visa irregularity is actually quite major because it threatens the national security of any country. It's quite serious. However, Audrey, for me, what is perhaps a bigger issue is if they came into the country on the basis of receiving some kind of security training and then they were actually receiving military training, who is really the perpetrator here? They might not have known what they were coming into the country for.
It is a security threat if people can waltz into the country on visa irregularities. But I also wondered, if you're coming in to do military training, to me, it feels like that is more threatening in the scheme of things. But of course, the two things are linked. Now, the case was withdrawn because of insufficient evidence, according to the National Prosecuting Authority. That must be surprising as well, right? Because they can't just arrest somebody. And they said that they had all this evidence and they said that they had, you know, weapons and stockpiles and all of that. So it's difficult to imagine that they didn't have enough evidence to bring charges.
Yeah, but I think what has happened there, Audrey, is that they apprehended the wrong cohort of people. Because like we mentioned earlier, the 95 Libyans were probably just pawns in the bigger scheme of things in whatever this syndicate or this operation was. The fact that Border Control allowed them in means that they vetted their visas and they allowed them in, okay? However that was done is a separate issue. The issue, I think, for South Africa at that time was the fact that there was an illegal military operation. So who was actually responsible for that operation, for that training? And I think that's who the person is. That's the perpetrator. So my suspicion is that there's the probability that South Africa, in their anxiety or their panic, apprehended people or had a charge against a group of people who should not necessarily have received that charge. And perhaps that's the reason they had to drop the charge.
Are you expecting that further charges would be brought against the right people in this case then?
Well, I would hope so. And I think that's what the country is hoping for as well. You know, the actual perpetrators to be brought to book. But having said that, I think this is a really complex case. And I think, you know, the South African police and Home Affairs are going to have to ensure that every stone is uncovered to ensure that all of their facts are in place to get the right people, the real perpetrators, to apprehend them.
How convinced are you that they will indeed do that?
So I have two schools of thought on that. The one is that they, you know, in terms of the international society, as well as the, you know, the community of South Africa, there is pressure on the government to find the real perpetrators. On the other hand, I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, this is going to also be reputational damage for the country, because there sounds like there was some kind of corruption that took place between some people and some place. And how are they going to balance both of those schools of thought? So, yeah, on the one hand, I think they might. On the other hand, they might not.
We have to bear in mind that these people came from Libya, and it seems like they were connected to the eastern part of Libya, which has a separate government that is not recognized by the United Nations and is run by, let's say, a warlord. Does that add to the complexity of this, the fact that it seems to be taking a stance against, you know, the complexity of Libya and the split governments there?
You know, it might or not be again, because unless we have all the data, all of the facts, I think it would be quite unfair to come to a conclusion.
You spoke about reputational damage that South Africa may suffer from this. What does the country need to do then to fix it?
So I think for me, it would be to be honest and take responsibility for what has happened, to show the world that there is consequence management for those who were responsible. And if there needs to be criminal charges against all perpetrators, we must give assurance to both the national and international communities that criminal charges will be meted out to those who are responsible. And that the whole world, and I mean, when I say the world, that includes our South African community, is taken through the entire process. And I think that will reassure definitely South Africans, but also the international community, that we are serious about what happens in South Africa. There are bigger impacts what this particular situation shows out. It could be a manifestation of other issues. So this is very important to showcase to the world that we have a strong criminal justice system.
What other issues do you think it highlights or hints at?
I think it would highlight the issue of corruption mainly.
Do you think that South Africans feel embarrassed by this?
There would be people in South Africa who would be extremely embarrassed. But I think more importantly, people are asking questions around privileged treatment for particular nationals or foreign nationals.
Can you expand a little bit more on that? Because I'm aware that the issue of Afrophobia, xenophobia in South Africa is never far from the headlines.
Yeah, so I think some of the questions that our communities are asking is, if this was, for example, nationals from another African country, would they have received the same kind of treatment in terms of being deported so quickly and easily back to their country versus nationals from other African countries? And I think also the fact that, they had such good legal representation expediently also raises questions. But of course, we don't know the dynamics and how that was actually obtained for them.
Thank you so much. That's really fascinating. Thank you.
You're most welcome, Audrey. Take care. I hope I was able to help.
That's Professor Nirmala Gopal from the University of KwaZulu-Natal. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people in Lesotho gathering water from a spring not far from their village. But just a few kilometers away lies one of Africa's largest dams, a key part of the infrastructure that transfers water from the mountains of Lesotho to South Africa, one of the economic powerhouses on the continent. Now, Lesotho is what is known as an enclave nation, which means it is entirely surrounded by another country. The country in question, South Africa, relies on water from Lesotho to survive. South Africa does all right out of this deal, but as the demand for water grows, the people of Lesotho are wondering whether this arrangement suits them. Focus on Africa editor Andre Lombard recently visited the region, and he's been telling me more about the project and why the people of Lesotho feel disadvantaged by the scheme.
It's kind of this interesting dichotomy that you've got this mega giant country, South Africa, and this relatively small nation. It's one of only three enclave nations in the world. It's a good pub trivia fact for you, along with
thank you,
San Marino and the Vatican City. But large parts of South Africa are quite dry and arid. And with the El Nino weather, large parts haven't seen rainfall for a long time. So there is water scarcity in parts of the country. And something Lesotho has that South Africa doesn't is large supplies of water. So it's this interesting phenomenon where Lesotho exports much of its water to South Africa, and it's a major part of the GDP of the country.
And how does it work?
So in the 80s, the apartheid government of South Africa looked and thought, well, there's a problem upcoming here in the fact that we can't get secure water supply to our country. So they started negotiations with the government at the time in Lesotho and agreed upon a water transfer scheme. So essentially what that means is that a dam was built, the Katse Dam. It was completed in 1996 and filled with water. And what that does is it captures water up in the Lesotho Highlands. Lesotho is an extremely mountainous country. There's an almost alpine feel. And then this water is transferred through a series of tunnels into the Vaal River system in the Free State in South Africa, then travels onto a dam that is built outside Johannesburg and into the taps of the residents of that city, as well as the Free State province and the rest of the Gauteng province as well.
I must just say that I feel like I was back in a geography lesson
in
high school in South Africa.
Oxbow Lakes.
Montauk Sources was the name of the highest source where the water actually comes from, a spectacular waterfall, by the way, in Lesotho. So that explains why South Africa is so involved in the politics of Lesotho, of course. But the people of Lesotho don't necessarily get the benefit of this massive resource that they have, do they?
No, many don't. Specifically, communities around the Katse Dam. So it's important to note at this point, the Katse Dam was the first to open in 1996. Then a second dam opened, the Mahale, in 2003. And there is a third that is scheduled for 2028 as well. So Lesotho are really trying to monetize this as much as they possibly can. But when I traveled up to the Katse Dam, it's a very kind of almost surreal experience because you're going through very rural areas that are made up of kind of huts and shacks. And, you know, you see lots of shepherds in traditional Lesotho blankets. And then you round the corner and suddenly you see this engineering marvel that is the Katse Dam, kind of feels almost like a spaceship plonked in the middle of this valley. And when I say engineering marvel, it's the second biggest curvature dam in Africa. It's a huge engineering feat.
And just another lesson, at the time that it was built, it was the biggest engineering project in the world.
Yes. Yeah. And you're thinking, how on earth did this end up here? And I think a lot of the communities around there have the same thought as me. Many were relocated to make way for this dam from villages that they've been in for centuries and thousands of years in many cases. But the communities that exist today on the precipice of the dam, some of them don't have access to clean drinking water themselves. I visited a village called Haramakotsi. It's about a kilometre up a gravel track from the dam. And when I arrived, there were several women waiting around what looked like a hole in the hillside, carrying empty paint buckets. And what they were doing was waiting for a small spring to start working in the hillside. And that was their supply of water. And they tell me that they did this daily, day in, day out. And when it dried up, often they would have to go on horseback to the next village, or they'd have to go without for the day. So you've got this very odd scene of this massive amount of water that you can see from the village, and yet they don't have access to any of it. And one of the women I met at that spring was a 50-year-old called Mrs. Molloy. She lived feet from the spring. You could see the dam from her window as well. And she was very angry. And this is what she told me.
The water shortage situation here is terrible. We are struggling to get water. Sometimes when it rains, a dead dog can be washed into the spring. We have to just take it out as we need the water, even if it's contaminated.
So that's Mrs. Molloy there. People must have made their feelings known about this. What's the government's reaction to it in Lesotho?
Yeah, so when I spoke to the village chief, he said that the previous government had visited in 2020 and made repeated promises that water would be given to the villagers, a clean supply of drinking water. He says these promises haven't been met, and the only time they see politicians now is when it's election. So I was quite keen to put the concerns that people like Mrs. Molloy and the village chief had to the government. I met with the Minister of Natural Resources. I put to him that these villagers still don't have access to clean drinking water.
Through these organizations such as LHD, LHWC, seem to be concentrating on provision of water to South Africa. And I'm saying we are now giving you 19 million people water in South Africa. We can't give 2 million people water in Lesotho. There's something wrong. These things should have been run parallel. If they had been run parallel, we wouldn't have people saying that they do not have safe drinking water. We've come up with a new strategic plan, which will make sure that those people get water and they also get electricity. So the hope is that by 2030, the lowlands will have ample water for everybody.
So you can give assurances that those villages will have access to safe drinking water by 2030?
I'll bet my life on it.
That's Molomi Muleko, a minister in Lesotho. So let's talk about South Africa. Massive benefits, obviously, for South Africa, being a water-poor country. To what extent does South Africa actually rely on the water from Lesotho?
So the two main provinces that get water from Lesotho are the Free State and Gauteng province. And those are both extremely important for South Africa's GDP. So Gauteng is home to Johannesburg, which is Africa's richest city. It's also home to Pretoria, which is one of the capitals of South Africa. So essentially the water in Gauteng, 60% of which comes from Lesotho, is being used to drive the economic heart of South Africa. It's also used in the Free State, which is quite a sparsely populated province in South Africa. You do have big cities like Bloemfontein, but a lot of it is farmland, small villages, mines. And that water is used to irrigate commercial farms that help feed the country as well. So it's an extremely important source of water.
So looking ahead, what do you think is the future of the water transfer agreement?
Well, with climate change, water is going to become a more scarce resource in Africa. Worst case predictions say, you know, water could become a source of wars in the future because of its scarcity between countries. So demand is only going to increase for Lesotho's water, not just from South Africa. A deal's recently been signed with Botswana, which is hundreds of miles away from Lesotho, to pump water over there. So it'll be interesting to see just how the government in Lesotho strikes that balance between monetizing one of their biggest natural resources, but also looking after the needs of their people.
Andre Lombard. Focus on Africa came together due to the efforts of Bella Hassan, Yvette Twagira-Maria and Nyasha Michelle here in London. Franny Joey stepped up in Nairobi. Kani Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Jonathan Greer and Francesca Dunn were the technical producers. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.